Welcome to WHRO's Weekly Edition. I'm Connor Worley, in for Jordan Christie.
And I'm Barry Graham.
We highlight the week's news and stories happening all over Hampton Roads. There's a new slew of stories headed your way in this week's program. Back in 2018, the federal government ordered all public housing to be smoke-free. But a new study from Old Dominion University finds that smoking is still prevalent in Hampton Roads' public housing.
A Portsmouth Firefighters Union is urging the city to make good on a promise it made 2 years ago to allow collective bargaining for municipal employees.
And a Virginia Beach doctor living with Parkinson's disease is advocating for hospitals to establish a universal protocol for handling Parkinson's patients. It's WHRO's Weekly Edition. Virginia crabbers are helping scientists map the bottom of the Chesapeake Bay. WHRO's Katherine Hafner dives into the details.
Watermen have been working with William & Mary's Virginia Institute of Marine Science to remove abandoned crab traps around the bay. Here's crabber Ralph Bonneville last year demonstrating a sonar unit that scans the seafloor to find the pots.
You go along and you see something on the screen, that little object, if you think that's a crab pot, you hit this for the market.
But this technology has another benefit. It collects data about the depth of the water every few seconds. VIMS professor Kirk Havens says that information is extremely valuable for accurate scientific modeling.
You can then have a better idea what storm surge will do. We have a better idea of different protections and resilience for coastal communities and working waterfronts.
He says it would take tens of millions of dollars to collect that data on their own. Katherine Hafner, WHRO News.
A new Virginia law could spur expansion of energy storage projects. But a recent vote in Chesapeake might reveal the limits of the measure designed to boost electric grid reliability. The Virginia Center for Investigative Journalism at WHRO's Elizabeth McGowan reports.
The Chesapeake Planning Commission in June denied a developer's proposal for a 150-megawatt battery storage project near Hickory High School. Chesapeake planners endorsed the Millstone project, saying it would encourage new energy technologies and diversify the city's tax base. But neighbors voiced concerns about the potential for noise and fire. Local environmental advocate Jeff Staples, who supports Millstone, said a not-in-my-backyard attitude has escalated. A new state law in effect July 1st mandates energy storage expansion. Proponents say big batteries hooked into the grid can lower electric bills and keep power on during outages. But the law doesn't stop cities from rejecting projects. The Chesapeake City Council is considering the proposal at its July 21st meeting. Elizabeth McGowan at WHRO.
The federal government ordered all public housing buildings to be smoke-free in 2018. But WHRO's Toby Cox reports a study from Old Dominion University suggests smoking in public housing is still widespread in Hampton Roads.
Lead researcher Bryn Sheehan says the idea behind the study was to see which communities were taking the smoke-free policy seriously and had better air quality as a result. She expected a mixed bag. Instead, the study found consistently unhealthy levels of particles linked to cigarette smoke in public housing buildings across the region. She says safety is a major reason why.
Many of our residents spoke very openly about the safety concerns around the communities, having to walk 25 feet away from the building. In many, if not all, of these neighborhoods is a very unsafe place to be.
Sheehan says covered and well-lit designated smoking areas near public housing could make a difference. Toby Cox, WHRO News.
What was on your breakfast menu this morning? Just coffee, a donut, nothing at all? Or did you stop and go full throttle pancakes and eggs, which many people are doing? Breakfast venues are the new hotspot for eating out. I eagerly decided to investigate.
Lines out the door, people sitting on curbs waiting to get in, reservations needed to get a table. Looked around lately? It's not Friday night at the trendy new eatery. It's mornings, and breakfast is suddenly big business. Restaurant analysts say that breakfast venues are seeing some of the largest growth in the market. Numerous restaurants dedicated to breakfast have opened in the region recently, and that's on top of long-standing diners that for years were already drawing in a steady crowd for eggs and hash browns. Since 2021, just in Norfolk, Eggs Up, Biscuit Belly, and First Watch have opened. What's behind the sudden rise of breakfast food? It's a tough assignment, but I decided to investigate. I wandered into Eggs Up in Ghent. It's tucked away in a strip mall off 22nd Street. It's become one of the real hotspots for breakfast since opening here 5 years ago. In between bites of my pancakes, I asked owner Steve McHugh, what's driving the rise in people seeking breakfast? He says it's all about appetite.
Everybody comes to breakfast hungry at the same time. When most people go to dinner, not everybody's always hungry, but everybody's always hungry for breakfast.
Eggs Up has developed a loyal following. McHugh says there's customers they see regularly, which he says, while encouraging, they also worry about the most.
I'd like to think because we're consistent, but those are also the guests that we have that make us the most nervous, because they're the guests that notice when something isn't exactly the same. So those are the folks that we are always super sensitive about, because they are also super sensitive. They can tell anything that's different here. It's not the same, or there's something off, they notice right away.
Eggs Up is somewhat of a family affair. Steve McHugh's daughter, Megan, works as a waitress and has since her junior year in high school. She said a diner like theirs creates a homey feeling.
I think breakfast restaurants, you get a sense of family going into like a breakfast diner. Like you could come into Eggs Up, you could come into First Watch, you could go anywhere and people will treat you more of a family type feel is what I've realized with everything. It's like you get a sense of home. It's home-cooked food, pretty much.
Breakfast is increasingly seen as a cheaper, more accessible way to dine out when compared to lunch or dinner, especially as prices for those meals have risen. A part of the lure also is that we live in a more health-conscious world than did previous generations. Those traditional cereals aren't cutting it for those wanting to eat well. Some breakfast cereals contain refined sugar. A 1.5 cup of cornflakes contains 4 grams of sugar and 300 milligrams of sodium. Yikes. Megan said traditional breakfast food is way better.
Now everybody's realizing you can't go wrong with breakfast food. Like, it's eggs, bacon, sausage, toast. Can't really go wrong with any of it. It's just a good staple.
The old adage of breakfast being the most important meal of the day seems to be certainly the mantra of late, and there's plenty of places around to pursue that thought. Though, as I explained to my waitress Megan, I was really there just to get information for my story.
Well, you must be an expert. I mean, it's your third time coming in this week. All of us know who you are, and our kitchen already has your order prepared by the time you're walking through your door.
For WHRO News, I'm Barry Graham. Hey, Megan, can I get some more of these pancakes here? I'm going to be doing some more research.
Still ahead on Weekly Edition, 2 supply ships were awarded the Presidential Unit Citation, a first for any supply ships. But first, a Portsmouth Firefighters Union is asking the city to make good on a promise it made more than 2 years ago to allow collective bargaining for municipal employees. The union says a formal method to start bargaining would help address its safety and staffing concerns. WHRO's Natalia Nelson tells us more.
The Portsmouth City Council approved collective bargaining for city employees in November 2023, in theory. But without an official ordinance setting bargaining parameters, workers can't begin negotiating with the city. Tiffany Stewart, the president of Portsmouth's Firefighters and Paramedics Union, asked the council during their July 14th meeting to follow through.
Show us a vote on the record and finish what you started. Our members answer emergency calls every day in the heat, the rain, and the shine.
Stewart said the fire department is understaffed, leading to overtime, low morale, and potential occupational hazards. Several council members said they wanted to look into staffing issues, but none directly addressed Stewart's request for a bargaining ordinance. Natalia Nelson, WHRO News.
Millstone Energy Center withdrew its application for a permit to build a battery energy storage system in the Hickory area of Chesapeake. The Chesapeake City Council approved the withdrawal in a 7-2 vote. WHRO's Natalia Nelson is back with this report.
Millstone Energy Center's planned facility off Centerville Turnpike South would use batteries to store energy from wind and solar sources for later use. Company representative Grady Palmer says it withdrew its application to gather more information.
This process has informed us and hopefully the city that if one of these projects were to move forward anywhere else in the city, that a substantial amount of studies that need to be done, that usually are done on the back end, need to be done prior to the council vote.
The Chesapeake Planning Commission recommended denial of the project earlier this month after hours of public comment. Residents of the neighboring Woodard's Mill area raised safety and contamination concerns. Millstone Energy Center can refile its application at any time. Palmer said he didn't know if they would refile with the storage center in the same planned location. Natalia Nelson, WHRO News.
A task force tackling safety issues in Virginia Beach wants to hear from the public. WHRO's John Doucette shares the latest.
Mayor Bobby Dyer announced the task force in May following concerns about crowds and violence. Its goal is to develop recommendations for city council. Members are working through issues about activities for young people, public safety tools, and building better communication and relationships. Next week, three public listening sessions are being held. Delegate Michael Fagans, co-chairperson of the task force, hopes citizens will speak up.
These are going to be the opportunity for the community to talk about how they see us, how they see their place within Virginia Beach, ways to make Virginia Beach safer, more welcoming.
The sessions are July 28th, 29th, and 30th. Information about topics, locations, and times is online at virginiabeach.gov. John Doucette, WHRO News.
Virginia's most rare plant, the Peters Mountain Mallow, only lives on one mountainside in the world, in the New River Valley along the West Virginia line. Last year, scientists counted just five plants that are still alive. And the ongoing drought means protecting it from extinction is getting tougher, as WMRA's Roxy Todd reports.
On a sultry summer day, I join three scientists as we hike up Peters Mountain in Giles County. We climb through sassafras and blackberry bushes and their thorns. Within 15 minutes, we're all sweating.
So we are a few hundred feet above the New River, climbing up the side of Peters Mountain. And we're about a third of the way up the climb.
Leighton Reed is an associate professor of ecological restoration at Virginia Tech. A half hour later, we reach the top. Here, trees thin out and there's more sunlight, exactly what Peters Mountain Mallow needs to thrive.
So it's got kind of maple-y looking leaves. They're a little bit fuzzy. It's got kind of a fuzzy stem.
Reed is crouching in front of a small green plant, one of only a handful that exists on the planet.
This species was discovered by a couple of botanists from West Virginia University almost 100 years ago, and this is the only place that anyone's ever found it.
Peters Mountain Mallow can grow to be several feet tall, with light pink flowers that look a bit like hibiscus. But today, all the plants are small, and only one has any sign of a flower, and it's small and shriveled. There's still a lot scientists don't know about what helps these plants thrive. They do know fire helps their seeds germinate. Fire also helps clear the forest of debris to allow more light to shine on the mallows.
If we could provide more sunlight for the species, if we could burn this habitat and allow some of the seeds to germinate, there are probably seeds that are underneath of the leaf litter that could cause the species to rebound again.
The Nature Conservancy in Virginia owns this property, and they began prescribed burns here in the 1990s. The Nature Conservancy's land manager, Sam Treslow, says the last burn was in 2017.
For the past few years, we have had plans each spring to conduct another burn. And this year specifically, you know, the prolonged drought conditions have made that not possible.
It's amazing these plants survived this long, but they almost didn't. In the 1980s, the Peters Mountain Mallow was placed on the federal list of endangered species, and the population dropped to just three plants. But after prescribed burns, the population usually rebounds quickly. Ryan Clough with the Virginia Natural Heritage Program was at the most recent burn 9 years ago.
Peters Mountain Mallow is simply one of, if not the rarest plant in the state. And so protecting and ultimately seeing that species restored through this collaborative effort with agencies, university, NGO, is just, you know, mission central.
And there is good news. In addition to the five plants they identified last year, Clough spots a small, healthy mallow. Reed says it's a good sign the plant is holding on for now.
Six individuals, which is one more than we found last year. Whether that one was here last year or we missed it, or whether it's a new one is hard to say.
They tag and record the new plant, named 006, and then enclose it with a small fence. After they've logged all the plants, the scientists tidy up their enclosures and nearby areas. Just as a gardener would, they thin some of the competing plants and pull invasives like garlic mustard to give Peters Mountain Mallow a fighting chance. Reed and his students are hoping to begin a new phase of the restoration project to collect seeds and try to germinate them in Blacksburg. Eventually, scientists may even try to grow them in new locations to help give the plant more chances to survive.
Because what could be more inspiring than studying the restoration of a globally rare species that occurs only 30 minutes away from the Virginia Tech campus. It's just a great opportunity to be part of global biodiversity conservation in our own backyard.
They're still waiting to learn if they'll be funded for this next part of their work. Either way, Reed hopes conditions improve for a prescribed burn soon, because without that, Virginia's most rare plant has little chance of making a comeback. In Giles County, I'm Roxy Todd.
People visiting Williamsburg's Merchant Square can now partake in some Pinot while they shop. WHRO's Nick McNamara reports the year-long pilot program started Monday.
Williamsburg is calling its beer and wine garden concept the Designated Outdoor Refreshment Area, or DORA. Williamsburg Area Restaurant Association Executive Director Rachel Sears calls it an exciting way to bring people together and enhance visitors' experiences. For at least the next year, some businesses will sell alcoholic drinks in specially branded cups, which people can carry around Merchant Square and into participating retailers. Posted signs will mark the DORA boundaries and which stores allow drinks. City Council approved the program in 2024, but needed time to get state licensure and companies to sign on. Williamsburg plans to evaluate how well it goes before its license expires next July. Nick McNamara, WHRO News.
Virginia Beach has a new permanent economic development director. WHRO's John Doucette shares more.
City Manager Patrick Dehaney announced the appointment of Emily Archer as Economic Development Director on Tuesday. She's been with the city for 11 years and has served as acting director for the past 6 months. The city's previous director resigned last year after only a few months in the job. In a statement, Dehaney called Archer an exceptional leader who has shown strategic insight. Archer has authored plans adopted by City Council and overseen major capital projects. She's scheduled to begin her role Thursday. The department has been involved in some closely watched issues recently, including expanding light industrial uses in the southern part of the city and possibly selling the Virginia Beach National Golf Club property near the Municipal Center. John Doucette, WHRO News.
Two supply ships were awarded the Presidential Unit Citation. WHRO's Steve Walsh says it was the first time supply ships were given the award in the history of the Navy.
The ceremony took place on the USNS Kanawha. The hulking supply ship provided fuel and fresh food to the USS Ford Carrier Strike Group during the war with Iran. Fleet Forces Commander Admiral Carl Thomas.
Obviously, we're in a little bit of unprecedented times having an adversary that's shooting at our ships in the North Arabian Sea. And so when you have them shooting at the ships and you got to defend them, you still have to supply your ships.
With Iran attacking U.S. bases in the Middle East, the Navy could not use its regular ports in the region. The sailors and civilian mariners of the Kanawha and the USNS William McLean were forced to travel longer distances and improvise to keep ships docked. Steve Walsh, WHRO News.
Virginia Beach Mayor Bobby Dyer has sent letters to federal officials asking to move forward on a needed route to Sandbridge. Dyer wrote Congresswoman Jen Kiggins and Senators Mark Warner and Tim Kaine asking the lawmakers to help move the long-planned Nemo Parkway project forward. The letter comes after a single-vehicle crash on Sandbridge Road on July 4th claimed the life of a Northern Virginia man. Dyer says a second access route is critical for public safety. The road closes due to traffic incidents and flooding, and nearby Dam Neck Naval Station has had to open detours for access in and out of Sandbridge. Navy representatives have joined in the efforts to get the second roadway open.
One Virginia Beach doctor living with Parkinson's disease wants hospitals to establish a universal protocol for handling Parkinson's patients. WHRO's Yi-Ching Wang tells us his story.
Howard Weinberg's stay runs on schedule. A retired doctor in Virginia Beach, Weinberg spent decades treating patients. His mother was diagnosed with Parkinson's in the early 90s. His sister was diagnosed with the disease 8 years ago. Then, after his wife died in 2024, Weinberg was diagnosed with Parkinson's himself. Weinberg says the biggest issue for Parkinson's patients is simple, yet hard to fix: getting their medication on time. He keeps his pill in a small container attached to his keychain, so he can carry it wherever he goes.
Now, I take my medicine every 6 hours.
And I happen to take it at 1, 7, 1, and 7 every 6 hours.
But Weinberg says that schedule does not always fit into a hospital routine, where daytime medication rounds often happen every 4 hours. Most Parkinson's patients take their medication every 6 hours, like Weinberg. But others need it every 3 hours, or even more often.
And it should be within 15 minutes of when it's due. And if you don't, then you lose mobility, you get so many complications.
Those complications can include falls, swallowing problems, and urinary tract infections. Weinberg, now a volunteer ambassador for the National Parkinson's Foundation, is pushing hospitals to establish protocols for Parkinson's patients, including a safe way for some patients to take their own medication on schedule.
I would love them to, or at least a partnership. So maybe the nurse knows they're in the room and in a place, and if it's 1 a.m. and the nurse hasn't come in to give you, you take the pills that are in the room, and then they see that you took them.
National data shows about 1.1 million Americans are living with Parkinson's disease. 1 in 3 patients is hospitalized each year, and 1 in 6 has avoidable complications during a hospital stay because they do not receive the right medication on time. Annie Brooks works for the Parkinson's Foundation. She says although federal rules allow hospitals to let some patients or caregivers administer their own medication, many hospitals still hesitate because of safety concerns.
It means you have to have some processes set, some expectations set. And so it's not something that a lot of hospitals do, but it is absolutely something that we hear from the Parkinson's community is a desired protocol, and is something that we continue to encourage hospitals to consider and explore.
The foundation is working with about 50 health systems nationwide to try to improve care for patients living with Parkinson's. Virginia Commonwealth University is one of them. Leslie Cloud is the medical director of the Parkinson's Foundation Center of Excellence at VCU. She says getting Parkinson's medication on time is a major challenge for hospitals because medication delivery depends on staffing and nursing workflow. One fix could be to allow some patients to take their own medication if doctors believe they can do so safely.
Because our patients are really good about taking their medications on time because they know what happens when they don't. And so they're more likely to get the medicine in that plus or minus 15-minute window if they have control over it themselves.
VCU is working on changes to its electronic medical record system to flag Parkinson's patients and warn providers about drugs that can worsen symptoms. They are also aiming to get Parkinson's patients their medication within 30 minutes of when they need it. Cloud says they ultimately hope to get that window down to 15 minutes. For Weinberg, those steps are part of the larger goal, making Parkinson's care a standard part of hospital routines.
I'd like to see every hospital in the United States and the world put in a patient's protocol for Parkinson's.
He has been advocating the protocol with local healthcare systems, but he says he's gotten nowhere. Yi Qingwei, WHRO News.
You've been listening to WHRO's Weekly Edition. We had help today from WHRO's Toby Cox, John Doucette, Catherine Hafner, Nick McNamara, Natalia Nelson, Steve Walsh, and Yiching Wang.
And VCIJ's Elizabeth McGowan and WMRA's Randy B. Hagee.
A reminder that you can always catch full episodes on the Weekly Edition podcast feed.
You can get your news updates at WHRO.org and the WHRO Reports podcast feed. For all of us at WHRO and WHRV, I'm Barry Graham.
And I'm Connor Worley. Have a great weekend.